And now, the moment you've all been waiting for.
Welcome to Social Media White Noise.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that, Ted, but we've had complaints that the intro's too long. Bugger.
Mouthful of strudel.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode... I'm not quite sure. What's the episode number, Nick?
We don't know. We haven't got the internet, Andy.
It's a I think it begins with 70 of Social Media White
80.
Noise. And today we have a special guest with us, Charlotte Stamper. How are you
Hello.
Doing?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. Good. And first of all, I've met Charlotte. And tell us your role. What role are you?
Hang on. Hang on. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the very start of the episode. Shall we maybe, A, introduce what the show is so people listening on their podcast can know they tuned into Social Media White Noise, episode number we can't remember who. The gentleman who kicked off with the conversation is myself, with a mouthful of apple strudel, Nick Butler, a.k.a. Loudmouth Man, followed closely by Andy White,
a.k.a. So you want me to introduce the coffee shop as well, do you?
You can do Dr. Pod, spelt D-O-C-T-O-R-P-O-D.
Okay, let's go back to the normal intro.
Yes.
I'm Andy White, aka Dr. Pod. That's Dr. spelt D-O-C-T-O-R-P-O-D. That's... I know pointing is useful.
We've just said who I am.
That's Loudmouth Man, and we're with... What's your Twitter handle, Charlotte?
Char Stamper.
Char Stamper. Is that C-H-A-R, Stamper?
Yeah, Stamper as it
sounds. Like a Pokemon.
Does it?
Yeah, Car Stamper. Sounds like it's a Pokemon upgrade.
Okay.
Come on, I choose you.
Stop being frivolous and just stick to the main thing of the show.
Fine, but this apple strudel is fantastic.
Now, Charlotte, while Nick's eating his apple strudel...
Yes.
We had you on the show because you're a big user of Twitter, aren't you?
I am, yes.
So we wanted to talk about the use of Twitter in councils.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps you'd like to fill us in on... Because you've been on Twitter quite a while, haven't you?
I have, yeah. About 3.5 years, I think.
Mm. So you were pretty much from the start.
Well, near the start, yeah.
Near the start. So you're a bit of a Twitter... Not junkie, that's not the word I was looking
for. I think
for.
I'm a bit addicted. I might describe myself as a junkie, actually.
Okay, so what sort of tweets are you putting out in connection with the council?
With the council, very different to my own personal account. There's far fewer swears on the council account.
Mm.
All sorts of stuff, really. We don't just link to news releases. We'll have a chat with people, see what's going on, talk about culture and what's happening and consultation and big government announcements that are affecting us, all sorts of bits and bobs.
And do you get much interaction? Do you get many people sort of coming back?
We do, yeah, we do, yeah.
So it's a very effective way of certainly not just broadcasting, but getting feedback as well.
Really good for a conversation. Probably the best way we've got at the moment to get instant feedback from people quickly.
Mm. We are here today, first of all, because of Catherine Ross.
Yes.
Of Catherine Ross Communications, a.k.a. QCatQ, on Twitter. And she brought Hillingdon's Twitter account to my attention, and this is one of those sort of weirdly fortuitous Twitter events that I was pointed to this because Horsham District Council decided they were going to start tweeting, and they were going to get their tweets out, and we'll talk a little bit about say Horsham District Council's social media engagement and their community engagement, because I think it is quite interesting, because when we looked at the Hillingdon account, it's clearly active in terms of being a communication point, and not just a broadcast point, but a listening point and talking with and to and around the community.
Mm.
And I thought this was great. So I tweeted Hillingdon and said it'd be lovely to get to know better. And it turned out it's yourself.
It's me.
It's you. And it's like, hang on, I know this person behind this account.
Yeah, well, me and my team. It's not just all
That's
me, but yes,
team.
Me and my team.
And I just said this would be a great opportunity to... We've spoken to Sergeant Peter Allen in the past about the police making use of Twitter. And I know that Justin Griggs, who is National Association of Local Councils involved, and there's a lot of Twitter accounts and so forth, and he keeps an eye on a lot of the sort of local council tweets and conversations goes on. It's always looking for really active and positive stories for councils.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of just, this seemed like this is a good first opportunity to come and talk to Hillingdon.
Sure.
Come talk to yourself and say a little bit about, where it started and how have you handled all the people who would say this can go wrong because.
Okay.
There you go.
How have we handled those people?
Inevitably, at some point, before this started, there had to have been some council meeting where somebody said, we want to do things in Twitter, or did that not happen?
I don't know. It was someone else in the team who actually went to the trouble of setting up the Twitter account and started the ball rolling on that. And then I came in at a later date and probably got was a bit more active with the account, actually tried new things, wasn't just linking to press releases and events that were happening, kind of had more of the conversation. In terms of people being worried about how it could all go wrong, I think we're really lucky at Hillingdon, actually, in that we've got a fantastic head of communications who I report into, and he's very, very trusting of his team, i.e. me and everyone else. So when we say we're comfortable, we can do this, we're confident, we know what we're doing, we're very much kind of trusted and left to get on with it. In terms of politicians and the powers that be, I think there's a certain amount of kind of ignoring the concerns that won't come to fruition, problems that won't arise. I think you just have to say, look, trust us. And then when you do get good responses, show them. I mean, I've gone with them. We were on Panorama a few months ago and I was tweeting throughout the programme and we had some brilliant feedback come back from residents. And I printed them off and we showed them to the leader of the council. And we're like, look at these brilliant things people are saying. So if you keep reinforcing why what you're doing is working, that's absolutely the best way, I think, for councils to deal with concerns like that.
So there is a mechanism that I've talked about in the shows in the past where we're saying that councils directly don't directly work for the residents, in the sense of the residents have elected people and have elected representatives, and it's those representatives who they should be approaching and talking to. And there's constantly been a level of disconnect that's either through a fault of administration or a fault of just a conceit that it's not needed to be reported unless it turns up in a meeting, that says people don't understand the level with which the communication happens across a council and into a council and into the elected representatives. And as you say, the MPs and the leader of the council, they get to see these communication messages and don't necessarily take part.
Yeah,
I know that when we sort of talk about this stuff, when we, and I say we, I'm a councillor for North Horsham Parish Council, and I know that I could bring up the concept of doing tweets, and I know that the conversation would be, why would we want to?
Yeah.
And then I understand that there will be people who will say, and this is how it will go wrong. Evidently, it doesn't have to go wrong.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually have to go wrong. Should we be making more of an effort to try something and fail? Or should we just say it might fail, we shouldn't try?
Well, I don't think you should ever say that with anything. You would never do any PR. I mean, as a comms department, we would never approach the Daily Mail with a positive story if we were constantly worried it was going to turn negative, because, I mean, that's almost a certainty with some newspapers. So I would never approach it like that, no.
And in terms of a taxpayer's investment cost to use Twitter as a tool to listen, what is it?
It's nil? Yeah, I mean, it's time, officer's time. It's just one of the many tools that I and my colleagues use. It's just, I see it as an addition.
It used to be the fax machine and now it's the tweet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you used to be stood at the fax machine and waiting for fax receipts to come out. Now you're an email.
I mean, we used to fax press releases. I mean, to say that is just ridiculous now. You would send out a press release and hope that the other end had paper in it, and then they would eventually get it before deadline. I mean, times have changed completely to the point where local newspapers are relying on our Twitter feed for up-to-the-minute information. Like, for example, during the London riots, we were tweeting all through the night, really concerned residents, but really quite scared, lots of rumours. We were really there to reassure. And it was really handy for the local press because they read our tweets, saw what was happening. They didn't have to call us that. It's just a brilliant platform to use right across the board. And it's very much integrated. It's not a... I don't think you need a Twitter guru in your team to do that. It should be part of everyone's job.
And this is a leading question now, but do you think it's because the residents are interacting that adds the value to what Hillingdon are getting out of Twitter?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the engagement that Hillingdon is doing is increasing the engagement with the residents?
I think it's that. I think the more you... It's all about, with any kind of comms, it's whether or not you have the right voice and talk to people. And you know people that are good at Twitter. They're chatty, they're interesting, and they're interested. They actually want to know what's happening out in their borough.
Yeah, they want to engage, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not just, you should find this interesting, here is a link to something. It's, what are you up to? What are you doing? What do you think of this? And you get residents that are, that that use it as a sounding board to complain, but not nearly as much as you would think. I would say 95% of residents saying either positive or neutral things.
I'm going to draw parallels in social media engagement with... There you go, that's a bingo word. I just said the word engagement.
having a chat.
In Horsham, the level of community involvement in online activity occurs in a Facebook group called facebook.com/horsham.uk.
Yeah.
And this Facebook group is about 7,500, 8,000 members, regular posting, lots of information, always coming in from residents and from the businesses. It was set up by a chap who works as an aircraft engineer. He actually set up a website called Visit Horsham that was promoting local businesses in Horsham. Again, he did this all off his own bat to promote Horsham. He then set up a Facebook group, and the Facebook group is not connected to the council, it's not connected to the local press. It's actually run by somebody who's just interested in
residents.
Saying, this is a Horsham group, please don't post, you know, regular adverts in here, and don't post for sale adverts in here, because that's not the place for this thing. But post in here that a road's closed, or post in here that a cat's lost.
Yeah.
And there is lots of engagement. But it has never happened on Twitter. And the council have opened a Facebook group, but they're going, you know, they're not getting engagement. Horsham has a Twitter account, and they're clearly sending out press releases.
They are, yeah. I had a look at their account earlier. It's kind of what not to do, really, I think, as a council.
And there's clearly not a lack of involvement in Horsham.
No, I think the point you make about residents being interested in a resident-run group but not in the council group is something that we thought about early on in terms of setting up our Facebook page. Mm. So it's not the Hillingdon Council Facebook page, it's the London Borough of Hillingdon. It's about the borough as a whole. It's not just your council telling you what's going on. It's very much designed so it feels more inclusive. Our Twitter handle is Hillingdon. It's not just Hillingdon Council. So it's kind of lumping everything in the borough in together, and the council is part of that. It's part of people's lives. It's not an authoritarian kind of...
Yeah, so it's sort of simplifying it a bit in a way, I suppose, isn't it? Yeah.
Certainly that's worked for us.
How have because inevitably, in every council structure, you have the council cabinet, you have the sort of committee and the councillors and the employees of the council, and then we have the sort of business entities, and so we have the Chamber of Commerce, effectively, and their group, and you know, Federation of Small Business and BNI group. How has that business end reacted to the sort of Twitter involvement?
If I'm honest, we don't have much involvement in terms of Twitter with them. I think the biggest thing we've done with Twitter is create lists of local businesses, and they actively want to take part in that. But again, that's not a Twitter thing on its own. That's part of a borough scheme that we run for residents called Hillingdon First, which is essentially a list of local businesses who are offering discounts to residents. We have a residents card, so it's like a membership scheme, as it were.
Yeah.
And businesses can sign up to that, and residents can get involved. So again, it's all integrated. It's not Twitter on its own. It's one of the communications tools we use, like we would use anything else.
And obviously this year we're seeing the Olympics, a jubilee, street parties.
Oh yes, I'm very excited.
Those things.
Yeah.
Did I detect a hint of sarcasm?
No. I love a street party. I won't be commenting on the Queen or any of the royal family. I don't. But no, I mean, our residents love all of that kind of stuff. Mm. And when we had the royal wedding last year, we had people tweeting their twit pics of their street parties to the council account, desperate to get it RT'd and show what they were doing and getting up to. So I imagine it's going to be the same for the jubilee party, and we've got loads of people signed up to have parties already. So
when we compare that Twitter was originally set up as a tool to help emergency services with communication, clearly you've adapted that communication tool in that way, and it's providing that services to it. If you could wave the sort of civil service magic wand over every council's approach to communication, things like Twitter and Facebook, what would you want? If you could have 2012 and you said, there's one small thing I would fix, but it would be this.
I think it would be having people who work in local government communications who actually really care about what they're doing. There's a big difference. I can look at another council's Twitter feed or their Facebook page and go, I don't really think the people running that are interested in what's going on. whereas I'm probably the most prolific user of the council account at work because I like talking to people, I like getting engaged. So it's really to have that enthusiasm. And that shines through in everything that you do as a communications team, is actually really liking where you work, liking who you work for, and being passionate about it. There's no kind of, in terms of the magic wand, I don't think there's any kind of piece of tech. Yes, it'd be lovely if our computers were a bit better and our internet never broke down, but can't have it.
So a faster internet would certainly benefit everybody, I feel. Do you hear that, BT?
So listen, Charlotte, you mentioned that, how many on your team that are actually doing the tweets?
We have 3 people in web who will link out to bits and bobs they're putting online. But in terms of reacting to resident inquiries, looking at crisis news stories, there's myself and 2 media officers.
Okay, and how do you manage the sort of who does what in there? Is it quite organic?
It is quite organic, actually. Yeah. I think in the past we've said, oh, do we need a strategy and do we need, you know, a flow chart? And it's like, no, actually, you don't. Yeah. You just approach it with common sense like you do media inquiries or newspapers.
A certain sort of JFDI approach.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're all in the same office, are you?
Sort we of, are, yeah. We're shouting with each other. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's really important.
So you won't accidentally both tweet out at the same time. It's a similar message.
No.
So are you using a particular tool?
We mainly just use web at the moment. We do use...
Shock horror.
I know. I've used TweetDeck if I've got my account open in the work account. That's fine. It's really great just for having your searches pop up and whatnot. But I don't like relying on those automated searches too much. I feel like you miss things if you're not properly looking. So I will go in there and I have a good nose about. It's very much about... listening.
It still
not
requires
spying.
People to look.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So presumably you've got a window open searching for some Hillingdon.
I'll search for the towns occasionally, so Ruislip, Hayes, Northwood, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, see what's going on. Often people are make a comment about Uxbridge Council. And you're like, you know, that's not... a lot of people don't understand how local government works. I don't think I did particularly before I...
I genuinely believe that we have a very poor communication of how government works.
I didn't until I started talking to Nick about it. When Nick started educating me.
Yeah, I mean, we are. I think if you don't know, you don't know.
I think there should be a podcast that is about local government.
Yeah.
I think it should.
Oh, yeah, but again, wouldn't that be a bit dry if you go back to my point about...
It depends how it was executed, I think.
It should be Andy and I, because we foolishly know so little...
Set up your own council.
So
why don't you do that?
It would certainly have entertainment qualities, wouldn't it? With my ineptitude on the way local government works.
I'll be joining you in that. I mean, it's one of the things that people don't appreciate is that councillors are making decisions based on what the clerks and officers are providing them.
Mm-hmm.
That information is being provided to them based on the data and facts they can get a hold of. So if you're not taking part as a member of the public in making sure that that information is also available or your concerns are made available, councillors can't make the best decisions for you because they're not being informed.
Mm. I think the thing I've learned since working for councils is absolutely get involved in consultations.
Yes.
Even if that means just email something, a couple of lines.
It doesn't matter how boring it is. Yeah, go along.
Absolutely.
Just turn up and make a noise because you should.
Yeah.
Because it
actually makes a difference. I think the thing with local government as opposed to national government is your voice can get heard so easily. It's so accessible to talk to your councillors and your MPs and even your officers and whoever you want. Brilliant.
I just want to raise a cup of coffee to you and your team.
Thanks.
And thank Hillingdon for setting a great example.
I'm raising my empty cup.
We should say thanks to our sponsors.
I'm not going to edit that bit out of me completely forgetting how to talk.
Edit anything.
Our sponsors, very pleased to say, King of Shaves
as our sponsor.
Yes.
So Nick's got something to do with your dodgy facial hair.
Nick has facial hair. But very, very well crafted.
It's nice.
Hair.
It looks neat.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, there we go. My dodgy facial hair. So King of Shaves, as a sponsor, have been involved with us before and were very kind in sending myself to Monkey Gras recently, which is a developers conference. And on top of that, so please keep talking about our products. So if you're unfamiliar with King of Shaves, and I suspect quite a few people are, you need to, man and woman each, you need to go back into Boots, and instead of seeing, as you always will, this bog standard best that you can get shaving option, I suggest you look a bit harder, because you're going to notice that there are these gels and these oils and these razors that you can buy that are not only cheaper, and cheaper is not the point here, it's the improvement in quality. The King of Shaves shaving gel, matched with the oil, matched with the King of Shaves Azure 5-blade shaving system, gives me not just a pleasant shave in the morning, and I've talked about other areas it's shaved very successful as well, but to say that it's given me the satisfaction of feeling that I'm actually having a shave that is more relevant to both the British economy, thank you William King, and supporting a more environmentally and frankly ethically improved approach to how we tackle shaving in the morning.
Charlotte could be using
at the Monkey Grill.
I'm not saying you have facial hair, Charlotte, at all.
Only a small moustache.
They provided the bags and the blades and shaving gel at the Monkey Grill event. And as a result, we had to have bags separated for the bags for the girls and the bags for the guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because the girls would have the girls' shaving foam, shaving gel, shaving blades, and so forth. The guys would have theirs. Technically, I don't believe there's any real difference, but there we go. Other than there's probably some more aloe vera and some different scents.
Well, men always complain that we blunt their blades, don't they? So maybe there's something in there.
Don't get me started.
This is a gentleman who shaves with shampoo conditioner, so I wouldn't
it works.
That.
Before I discovered the kinks of King of Shaves, I used to shave with conditioner, because it's quite slidey.
Absolutely. It's good for the hair, it softens it.
Thank you to King of Shaves. And thank you to... this is Coffee Break.
Coffee Break
in... Is it Hillingdon? Uxbridge High Street.
Charlotte can describe where it is, because this is unfamiliar territory to us.
It is on the High Street. If you walk from the tube station towards the beautiful Civic Centre, past Waterstones and up towards Boots, it's just there. Very
just
red.
Opposite.
I always thought it was called Café Rouge, because it's so red, but it isn't.
They have provided us with great coffee and a fantastic apple strudel, all of which has been paid for today by King of Shaves. So
we salute
you,
King of Shaves, and we salute you, the coffee shop.
Thank you for the coffee.
Hey, talking about close shaves.
Yes.
How about Path?
I sense a segue.
You know, I managed a smooth one from
I've roughened it for you, haven't I?
We have.
I've roughened the smooth segue.
You know, this is one of these things where when you talk about it, it begins to be seen.
Tell us about Path. What happened?
The path you must follow. There's this iPhone application that got a lot of traction, got a lot of investment, got a lot of money spent on it, and it upgraded to a version 2 that everybody kind of liked, because suddenly you could log into Path and you could say, I'm here, you could check in where you are, you could send photos.
So it's a bit like Foursquare.
And it's a bit sort of Foursquare meets Twitter.
Location-based.
And so forth. And everybody thought this is a really wonderful tool, until a developer who was playing with a tool that let you... put a proxy between your iPhone connection and the internet and therefore see what was going on and communications between your iPhone and the rest of the web, spotted that Path was sending the complete copy of your address book. So
up
not just your username, not just your name and your telephone number and an email address, but basically the address book. And if
the entire unencrypted address book up into the cloud.
If like me, also store occasional information related to clients in your address book, that's just gone to Path.
Yeah.
Well, needless to say, that story, when it broke, started off with a couple of comments, and in less than 24 hours was 300 comments long. Now, Dave Murrin, who is the co-founder at Path, and he's actually responsible for handling the sort of PR and the conversation that went on, approached it and said, yes, I'm sorry we're doing this. It's not unusual that most companies will do this. However, if you want to write to us, we'll delete your data. And a lot of people pointed out that it's not enough that you delete the person's address book. What if I've given somebody some information that they've stored in their address book and I want that deleted from... So they actually did eventually turn around after 24 hours and they said, we are now deleting all the data.
Okay.
And with luck, they're deleting all the data from their backups.
Mm.
But the point is, it happened. And about the same time this happened, the Microsoft store in India online was hacked. And usernames and passwords were recovered. So imagine if before this had occurred, before we knew about this problem with the address books, Path had been hacked.
Yeah, yeah.
And they wouldn't just get hold of usernames and passwords. Now they'd actually have the big address book of everybody else who's on that system. They'd have those address books, which is a fairly scary question. So the question is, do we own the data that people give us?
Well, we've been here before, haven't we? This whole thing about data that you've got that... would actually cobble someone else up if it got out, but not so much you, like other people's data that you just happen to have and that going out. So it's the same. I think I invented a name for it, didn't I? It was secondhand data or something, or
secondhand data
third party, I was, something
well,
like
I've
that.
Always insisted that us individually won't screw up our privacy, but our friends will screw our privacy.
Yeah.
Our friends will tag us in Facebook and that blows our cover.
Yeah.
You know, our friends are now joining Path and uploading all our content. If I've been given a telephone number, a trusted telephone number, for somebody, if I had Kylie Minogue's telephone number, let's go with the fantasy option here, and that went up on Path, then anybody else who was at Path would be able to see Kylie Minogue's telephone number. Hang on.
But what were they doing with the data once it was uploaded?
Well, did they say, why they were taking...
So their position on this was that by having the data, they would then be able to compare your address book information with other Path users and work out who you had connections with to make suggestions that you would want to be friends.
Okay, so they weren't going to redistribute it, they were just using it internally to...
They promised, not going to do anything irresponsible with your data, governor. Oh no, you can trust us.
Mm.
But it's been pointed out by developers, it was pointed out by me, that if you wanted to do that, you could do what's called a hash, which would make a unique key of the email address and the address book. So you could hash the address book contents, which would create unique numbers.
Ah, yes, of course.
And you could just upload those unique numbers.
So that's a proxy for the data, an unreadable proxy for the data.
It would be an unreadable proxy for the data.
Yeah.
So the hash would be at their end. They wouldn't be able to read it. No one would be able to read it because a hash is a one-way key.
Yeah, yeah, it's just a little
data
gibberish.
Goes in, it gets gibberished up.
Yeah.
But if you put that same data in, it will always get gibberished up into exactly that way.
The same gibberish, yes. Yeah.
So then you could see the same gibberish at two ends and match those strings.
Yeah,
That's all you'd want to do.
Yeah.
That means, and that's so simple to do, any programmer would know to do that, which means that the programmers at Path had to make the choice, or the discussion, or just not get involved in thinking to that next level.
Mm.
At which point, despite the fact Path has said, we've deleted our data, your data, a lot of people have already said, no, I'm leaving Path. You know, they changed their profile. I'm leaving Path and deleted their Path account from my iPhone.
Mm.
We are left with the question, how can we trust other applications in the future? We actually need to have a
Doesn't the iPhone stop that from happening?
No.
Uploading data?
No, and it should be in there. It should be a mechanism in there that says, this is only available if you opt in.
Right, okay.
But here's the thing. I have already put it in my emails and I've put it on my little agreement now, and I'll make it in this part of this podcast.
Oh, you're a big footer.
Right,
I've seen it.
Which is, you are not entitled to copy my data.
Mm.
So if you have my information in your address book, I do not give you permission to share your address book with my information in it.
Mm.
So share an address book, but without my information in it, by all means. That's what I require.
Mm.
And that's interesting. How would you do that? How could you possibly stop that? There's the Data Protection Act, which was set up initially, and I'm sure the council has to have a lot of fun with data controllers, data controller officers being assigned, specifically because people's information. Now, Twitter accounts are an interesting offset of people's actual information, and they haven't really worked out what that means in terms of data controllers yet, because it's not legitimately an email address, and it's not actually a way to contact that person privately, other than publicly. Is this something that you have to handle in a sort of user agreements or guidelines, Charlotte?
We certainly don't have that for Twitter. But to be honest, we've got no interest in siphoning people's data from any source particularly. As I mentioned earlier, the residence cards, we have people's data on that. It's chipped like it would be in an Oyster card or whatever. And people are like, you're just collecting data on where I'm going. And really, it says which library you're at and where you might have used your discount. But, I mean, we genuinely wouldn't be after any of that from people unless they had specifically said, contact me by email, here's our email address, and then we would never pass it on. So, despite what people may think, we're really not after data collection like that.
There's the transparency thing, which says, we'll make that information so transparent that you can see what we're doing with it. And I know there's a big push for freedom of information to get information out of councils back into some public hands. I know I'm looking at things like Fix My Street and wondering how we could link things like Fix My Street to Twitter so that we could have a more interactive level of, this was recent, it's in your area. If you're on Foursquare, Fix My Street should pop up on Foursquare and say, hey, you're here, go and look at that, has it been fixed? There's still too much asynchronous. It goes in siloed and never comes out again.
Yeah, it needs to be better all connected. And I think the difficulty is where you've got 200 councils or 300 or whatever it is, all using separate ways of doing things. It could be better joined up, definitely.
Some would use Access, others would use Excel spreadsheets, others might actually use a database.
Yeah.
Somebody else might have gone out and gotten a third party to build an application
for it.
And each one of these things. There is a really good reason to say, look, this is government, this is data that's been created by the public, and it's actually going to benefit the public. If we make it available to the public, what can they do with it whilst mm-hmm. we're working out how to fix mm-hmm. it?
Yep.
But that's open data,
I know that's
standards.
What things like yep. GDS is involved with, which is the right. Government Digital Society Service, GDS. They're responsible for gov.uk,
yep.
which just launched last week, mm-hmm. And is a new type of interface to the sort of government information that you can go out and get a hold of. But whether that sort of approach will filter down into other ones,
I think, in fairness, local gov's pretty good at making all of our data available. There's almost nothing you can't find on our website. It's all...
Well, you say that, but I have the video that shows that West Sussex County Council said, we'll produce information on business rates for your area.
Yeah.
And I was 20-odd clicks in, and I still couldn't find
really?
It.
Well, business click rates count. Are set by national government, aren't they? We're just the bailiff, as it were. But, I mean, it should... Yeah, there are problems like that with websites.
There are problems with that, and the only way they can be fixed is by highlighting them. Finding the actual data that's supposed to be talked about and say, look, just put this information that I finally found back up at the top of this site, because that's what you're going for.
I think
for.
There's a problem with reports. I mean, I was trying to look for some budget information yesterday on a council website, and it's all buried in PDF reports. And I think, you know, if we could produce that in a better way, but that doesn't mean you have to replicate all of your information, pay another officer essentially to do that. If we can find a way to better do that, we absolutely should.
Although, would in paying for another officer to do that, and therefore making that information easier to get to, long term reduce the inefficiency costs that are created in other sectors?
That's a good
question. Would a very small cost here, because it would be a smaller cost there, actually result in a larger saving across a wider area?
We'd have to look into it. I mean, there's certainly the cost of an FOI officer, Freedom of Information officer, who's constantly digging around for information.
But we're getting into a whole other political podcast.
Sorry, yes.
And we should do.
On that final question, which is a very good question, what a stupendous place to end the podcast at 31 minutes and 50 seconds in. So thank you very much, Charlotte Stamper,
for
joining us today.
Lovely to meet you guys.
On Twitter, we can follow you as?
Char Stamper. Say hello.
That's
I like
C-H-A-R Stamper.
Yes, as it sounds, like a stamp you get in the post
Char
office.
Stamper. Char Stamper.
Yeah.
And thank you to Loudmouth Man as ever.
Yeah. AKA loudmouthman.com.
And thank you to me, Andy White, Aka Doctor Pod, Doctor spelled out fully.
Do not forget, if you have enjoyed the show, if you enjoyed the subjects of the show, come to socialmediawhitenoise.com, leave a comment on this blog, or better yet, pop into that donate button. Click on that donate. I'm sorry, it's PayPal. I have no other way to do it at the moment. And I'm sorry it's PayPal, but please leave a donation. £10, £15 will quite happily buy us a coffee and cakes, and the conversation can carry on continuously, credibly and comfortably, and I shall say ciao ciao.
Now Nick's finished saying goodbye. Thank you very much for joining us, folks. We'll see you next time on Social Media White Noise. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Social Media White Noise, brought to you by Andy White, Aka Dr. Pod, and Nick Butler, Aka Loudmouth Man. Please visit www.socialmediawhitenoise.com, where you can leave comments, listen to the show straight from the webpage, and subscribe for free. Email us at ulot@socialmediawhitenoise.com. Follow us on Twitter, Dr. Pod and Loudmouth Man. We'd like to thank the coffee shops of Sussex, Social Media and Technology, without whom this show would not be possible. See you soon. Peace.